Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Welcome to Week, the Commonwealth Club's Political Roundtable program for Monday, January 13th, 2014. Thank you for coming to join us on our first week-to-week program of the new year. I'm John Zipperer, your host for week-to-week. And as always, we're going to be discussing some of the important and interesting and just strange events of the past week or two. Of course, any opinions expressed up here are just those of the speakers and not necessarily those of the Commonwealth Club. Speaking of people with opinions, let's meet our panelists. I'm going to start on the far end. There is Joe Garofoli, political writer for the San Francisco Chronicle, and you can follow him on Twitter at Joe Garofoli. Next to him is Melissa.
Everybody, wait, let's get the spelling going. No, nobody knows how to spell Garofoli.
J-O-E.
Forget a plug, let's plug.
J-O-E-G-A-R-O-F. Oh, I got lost in your name. L-I?
That was good. That
very
was
good. Okay.
I hate to say, but a colleague on a double byline story that will be in tomorrow's Chronicle misspelled my name. Carolyn Lockhead.
Next to Joe is Melissa Griffin Kane, a political analyst at CBS San Francisco, a political writer for San Francisco Magazine, and an attorney. You can follow her on Twitter at Mel Griffin Kane. Search it. And between us is Josh Richmond.
Just don't even introduce me.
You've got the one name people can guess. He's a state and national politics reporter for the Bay Area News Group. That's, of course, the San Jose Mercury News, Oakland Tribune, and some other places. And he's online on Twitter at Josh_Richmond. Don't have to spell that one at all. So. As always, there are question cards spread throughout the room. Use those to send us some questions. We'll try to work them into our program. I'll answer as many of them as we can. And I wanted to just get started with a regional story that is national because of who's involved, and that is a certain governor of New Jersey who's been having a very bad week. This started with revelations that some of his top aides had been involved with getting a partial closed shutdown of a bridge because the local mayor, wasn't playing ball. So, Joe, just how bad of a week was this for Chris?
Oh, it was a bad week. It was a bad week. And you know, the lesson here is if you're going to screw somebody, just be more subtle about it. You know, there's no political payback goes on all the time in every level of government. That's, you know, let's be real here. But, you know, it usually is something along the lines of, well, you didn't help me out. You're getting a terrible office.
It's a subtlety.
There's a subtlety here. You know,
and not writing it down.
Yeah. And you screw over the politician, not the people, and the people who are potentially could be your voters or supporters or whatever. So that's the dumb lesson to learn here. And also the folks who are involved, you know, Christie's direct fingerprints weren't on this thing, as we know of yet, but he created an atmosphere where his underlings are doing something that they think will make the boss happy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that goes on in every office around, although most offices you can't close the George Washington Bridge. He had a bad week, and I don't know. Hillary Clinton, does that help her? I don't know. The question I keep talking to people about is, are people going to remember this in 2 years?
I think another question is he really that strong of a contender anyway? I mean, what early primary states does Chris Christie carry, you know, the Republican base? Probably not Iowa.
Not Iowa.
Probably not South Carolina.
No. New Hampshire.
New Hampshire, maybe. Well, you know, but they like a different kind of bluster up there, I think.
Right.
Not quite the Jersey bluster that Christie's been delivering. Anytime you have a CNN, you know, headline rolling by, it's like, who's worse for New Jersey, Snooki or Chris Christie? Which I saw today. I'm not making this up. it's a bad week. It's the passion of the Christie, for sure. So.
Well, tomorrow is the New Jersey State of the State speech. Chris Christie has to get up and give his state. I have to say, it's probably going to be one of the most watched in many years. I will say this, though. I am not entirely convinced of this narrative that he's doing this to get back at this mayor who didn't endorse him. It's very unsatisfying, right? The mayor himself says, I wasn't asked to endorse Chris Christie. And Chris Christie goes on TV and says, I couldn't pick this guy out of a lineup. The whole thing doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. And I'm very open to alternate explanations. Rachel Maddow has given one. Up with Steve Kornacki has given one. There are other ideas, I think, swirling around about what happened here. And I think we still don't know what's happening yet. Even Marco Rubio, and I'm paraphrasing here, said something to the effect of, I am so not getting involved in this until we figure out what's going on. So I think a lot of people, myself included, are still waiting to figure out exactly what happened. Again, I don't know where the endorsement theory came from, but I don't really buy it, and I think that there's something different going on. And I think once we figure that out, that's how we'll know more clearly how it will affect him in the long term, because if he did do something like this, if his fingerprints are in any way near this, or if he's really creating this kind of atmosphere, then this is not the only thing, right? This isn't like, oh, I did this one thing, and then everything else is totally up and on the up and up, right? Something else is going to come out. The facts are going to keep unraveling, and he's surrounded by Democrats in New Jersey who are going to have hearing after hearing, and they're going to get every email, and they're going to get every text message, and he doesn't have a lot of friends in the state legislature, and they're going to go after him. And I think we'll know more, again, about the long-term effects of this once the facts of this are borne out, and again, potentially additional scandals,
Watch for it to get worse before it gets better.
Right.
So what are the alternate explanations? I mean, someone tweeted that after he gave this two-hour speech or press conference, where he was apologizing and explaining that he couldn't have done this, and his aides, had never told him about this. And someone tweeted something to the effect of, I don't know what my staff is doing, and they're running amok. That's not really a great defense for a political leader. I mean, what?
The alternate theories are twofold. Rachel Maddow brought one up, and she said, look, there was a state senator, Laura Weinberg, I think is her name, who was the head of the Democrats in the Senate, and the Senate had decided to stop approving judicial appointments that Chris Christie kept trying to make. And she represents that district in which Fort Lee sits. Mm. So, don't look at the mayor, look sort of higher, look at the Senate district and look to see that is the leader of the Democrats in the Senate who at that time were preventing any judicial nominee of his from going forward.
That rarely happened before. I mean, almost never happened before to put the kibosh on
a series
of them.
And he was very mad, and he was in the press saying, I'm not going to put I like this woman, Helen, who I've nominated, and I'm not going to put her through the ringer. So he was out there making very bold statements about how angry he was about this. So that's theory one. Theory two, from Up with Steve Kornacki, is that there is this, if you look at the bridge and sort of the on-ramp, right beneath it are these 16 acres of land, and there's these two parcels, an east parcel and a west parcel, and they're awesome real estate. They're kind of incredibly well situated to be where they are. It's kind of like our Piers 30 and 32. You're like, how does that just sit there? I don't know. But for like 40 years, no one's built anything, and they're totally just like dirt squares. And so finally, this mayor of Fort Lee said, my legacy will be to build something on this dang land that we have. So he gets these proposals, right? One parcel is residential. One parcel is this billion-dollar project that is commercial use and residential use and parking spaces, and it's a billion-dollar project. And one of the selling points to get financing for this project is its proximity to the bridge, is its accessibility to the bridge. Three lanes. Woohoo! Invest in us. So that was the sale. So right around the time that they were trying to get financing for this project is when the lanes got shut down. Right? And everyone's going, wait just a minute. We don't know exactly what's going on here, but the timing is super weird. The financing for this major project on this piece of land that everyone's been trying to get their paws on for 40 years, and all of a sudden, now you screw us on the on-ramp? Wait just a minute. Now, so thankfully, federal appointee, the executive director of the Port Authority, a federal appointee, he's the one who kind of jumped in and was like, what are you doing? This is crazy. This doesn't make any sense. He jumped in and he stopped the bridge closure, and so the project was able to get funding, some $200 million. So that was actually fine. But what the theory is, and it's not it's a little more satisfying, but it does leave open some questions, is that there was something about this development that somebody in the governor's office didn't like. They wanted a different contractor. They wanted to appoint a crony. Maybe there was somebody involved that they didn't want to be involved. But something about this thing the governor's office wanted to change. And so they stepped in there to, you know, create some traffic in Fort Lee to try and monkey with that selling point and sort of assert authority over their ability to get financing. So I'm sorry that's like a 20-minute explanation, but it's kind of complicated.
That's actually pretty good.
That's
a good breakdown.
But that, so it's basically the same scandal, different target, or different victim, intended,
different purpose.
Yes.
Right, it wasn't about the endorsement, it was about this project.
Yeah, but you're not going to see Chris Christie come out and say, see?
Yeah, oh yeah.
I wasn't doing it to the mayor, I was doing it to...
It's not a direct hit on a politician, which is politically dumb. I mean, it's politically clumsy and ham-handed, which is the...
Well, I mean, Christie's bad week or bad month, I guess it could well be continued. He's now, his administration is going to be under investigation by the federal government over the use of Hurricane Sandy Relief Fund. Do you want to talk a bit about this, Josh?
Yeah,
which coincidentally is why people in his own party didn't like him, because he was so cozy with the president after the hurricane and sort of put a thorn in the side of Mitt Romney's campaign at a crucial moment. Not that there weren't a lot of thorns already stuck in there, but it's a big cascade of trouble for Christie. Like we said before, I would reserve judgment on any single element of that until we know more about them. But the fact that all of this is happening within a couple of weeks, that it's all coming to the fore within a couple of weeks, does not bode well for his aspirations. I don't think he's going to quit.
He does not seem like a quitter.
No, he seems like many things, but not a quitter. But so close on the heels of a convincing electoral victory, no matter how bad this gets, as you said, unless his fingerprints are directly on it and there's a very clear smoking gun, like that email, for instance, don't write it down. This is something they teach us in the media, like immediately. If you don't want to see it in the paper or on the website, don't write it down. Don't put it in an email. Don't put it in a story file. Mm-hmm. Don't write it down. And yet, they wrote it down.
They wrote that, yeah. No, it's and, there's also in the Game Change follow-up book that came out,
Double Down,
they said when Romney went to vet him to be vice president, they found a whole bunch of financial dealings that weren't really either, they were underreported or not reported at all.
From his time in
from
business.
From his time before in the business world, in the private sector. So, he really has not been vetted at the national stage. He's a very compelling character. We've seen him speak, and he's unlike most politicians. That's why he's a compelling guy, but at the same time, he has not been through the national vetting machine. He's not been apparently through the local vetting machine either. So he is still an unknown quantity. A very large unknown quantity.
I had to get one in. You had to get one fat joke. Come on.
Okay. In the interest of some bipartisan presidential defeating of ambitions, Hillary Clinton, also obviously the presumed candidate or potential candidate for the Democrats. I'm kind of curious. Some of the stuff that's been swirling around on the Democratic side, she of course wasn't involved in Obamacare, but she's very connected to health care. She came up in the Secretary Gates book, the former defense secretary. Will that make her look disloyal to Obama? Any thoughts on, has she, is any of the luster rubbing off, do you think?
I think by the time she's publicly launching a campaign, her support of Obamacare is not going to be that much of a liability.
Yeah.
I think as the enrollment figures continue to roll along, as technical glitches continue to be worked out, as it becomes clearer just how many people benefited from the law as opposed to not, benefiting from the law, I just don't see that as a major obstacle for her. The Republicans will continue shouting about Benghazi through Election Day in 2016, but I also don't think that's going to be a huge drag on her either. I think her situation is deciding whether she wants to go through this again.
Yeah. and raise $2 billion or whatever it'll be.
Yeah, and just the personal toll and the toll on her family, although her family situation is, you know, who knows, right?
Well, I talk about not having been vetted. She, of course, has been vetted in the sense that she's been in the public eye and really a target for two decades. So I kind of figure everyone who is potentially going to dislike her already dislikes her.
Right.
They're already voting for whoever is in the Republican camp. And it's like, I think you're probably right. It's kind of, does she want to do it?
Yeah. I think she's having a great week. Are you kidding me? Well, I mean, in all the polling matchups, Chris Christie was the one person who, and again, this is, you know, a million years before Election Day, but at least initially, and all, you know, Hillary versus Rubio, Hillary versus Ryan, Hillary versus Chris Christie, that was the closest one. I think if I'm in her campaign, I'm, you know, not unhappy that this is happening.
but for the same reason, that's why Chris Christie finished dead last in the Des Moines Register's poll just before Christmas.
Yeah.
You know, it's a troubled path to the nomination for that guy, even without all of this stuff. You know,
well,
it's not an easy row for him to hoe.
Well, it's also why he's being hung out to dry a little bit right now, right? The base hates him.
Yeah.
And, you know, other folks don't want to attach themselves to him because then it seems like they're choosing him as their candidate prior to 2016. Everyone wants to keep their options open. So the only people you're seeing actually step out and defend him are people like Reince Priebus, who, you know, that's his job, is to defend Republicans. So, okay, we'll give you that. Rudy Giuliani, who, you know, he's kind of a player, but he doesn't really have much skin in the game one way or the other. And John McCain, who's come out and kind of given a little, you know, tepid encouragement. But you haven't seen, like, sort of an overwhelming, you know, gathering of Republicans having his back. So now he's under fire by the Democrats in his state, and he's got nobody really really defending him. And it just goes to show you that other Republicans, at least, are thinking, there's a possibility that something sketchy went on, and let's just wait.
Fox News isn't really touching this one. They're not. They've given very little airtime.
They're going to interrupt their Benghazi coverage.
Yeah.
Why didn't you do this with the IRS story? They say.
No, but I think that's the telling part about that is that, you know, a lot of the Republicans aren't really hearing a lot about the Christie thing. So maybe that might be sort of a tacit form of protecting him, of just saying, well, you know, let's see, you know, if there's anything to this. So if they wanted to blow them out of the water, they'd be going wall to wall on this. There's certainly enough to talk about there. So I'm thinking that he's still got a chance.
Chris Christie?
Oh, yeah.
As good a chance as he ever had.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, let's stay with national politics a bit, or at least the national scene, and talk about our weird budget situation in the federal government. Of course, I could have said that sentence any time in the last, you know, however many years. But we kind of have this weird sort of almost kind of squint, and it's almost like peace or truce, or is it just people keeping their gunpowder dried? As I think everyone knows, back in, was it December, Senator Patty Murray, a Democrat, and Republican Representative Paul Ryan, the respective chambers budget chiefs, came to a budget deal, got it passed actually by pretty strong majorities in both houses, and President Obama signed it. What people were kind of hoping, of course, is that, okay, good, this means that in January when the government needs to be refunded, and then in early February when the next debt limit fight comes, that maybe there won't be fights. Any sense on, from what's been happening since then and anything you know about going on, are we going to have peace in our time?
No way. I don't think there's...
You're out of business.
Yeah, no. First of all, it's an election year. There's really no incentive to have peace. There's no incentive to compromise. As sad as that is to say, it's true. And of all the big issues in front of this Congress, you know, immigration, the budget, the raising the minimum wage, all these things, where's the middle ground going to be? Who are the people in the middle? I mean, there's still the demographics of this Congress have not changed. Demographics of the Congress won't change until, as someone, a historian told me a couple weeks ago, 2020. Because the next time that there's a census and there could be a possible changes in some of these states in the way they elect their representatives, it's really bleak to think about it. But there's one party rule one way or the other,
yeah.
We're going to be just sort of talking so the same thing.
I'd agree with the caveat that if anything, if there's going to be any compromise, any cooperation, it'll be after June, after the primaries are done.
Yeah.
Everybody's going to make sure that they don't get primaried.
True.
And then some people in the very, very few swing districts that are out there will be inclined to want to strike deals and appear, you know, somewhat more moderate and you know, more appealing to a broader spectrum of voters. But like Joe said, you know, there are so few swing districts. The country is gerrymandered so badly at this point that there won't even be that many people who feel a need to swing back to the center to make compromises through the rest of the year.
They're all safe.
Well, what you're hearing today is about this great compromise that just got passed, right? That the parties have come together and they've made this $1 trillion budget deal. Okay, so what John was just saying is that back in December there was a deal sort of in theory, right? There was big numbers, like we'll give you this many billion, you get that many billion, but there were no details around that deal, right? It was just a sort of a handshake on broad outlines. So what you see today, I mean, what's reported and what you're going to see tomorrow is sort of the details being filled in on all of those things. And what they did is they pushed them all together. There are 12 appropriations bills, and they're pushing them all together, and they're saying vote up and down, no amendments, because it's the only way we're going to get this done. If you start picking this apart, if you start voting on it separately, then forget it. So you'll get a deal on that. Like, this thing ideally is going to pass. It seems like both parties have the votes to do it. However, on February 7th, then we get to our debt ceiling debacle, and Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell, GOP representatives, have already said we are not going to pass a clean debt ceiling. We're going to get something in exchange for our debt ceiling vote this time around. So we're going to have another debt ceiling fight. President Obama has said, I won't accept anything but a clean debt ceiling raise. One suggestion has been that maybe amend the Affordable Care Act, of course. It's always everything. It all comes back to Obamacare. It would be to amend Obamacare somehow, and I don't even know how this would work, but somehow amend it to allow people to keep their current physician. So, you know, you like your plan, you can keep it. Sort of enshrining that thing into the law. And what's interesting about this is it seems like a minor tweak, and it might actually be something that the president might have to consider. Because it's not like a massive repeal, you know, it's not, you know, and the Fed. It's something that's sort of small and discreet that seems kind of popular. And so we might actually have another debate, but it might be over something, a couple of smaller demands from the GOP come February 7th. So in the immediate term.
Mm-hmm.
But to your point, everyone is trying to hold firm because they've got these June primaries coming up. So that's going to play a lot into how they react and how they grandstand during the debt ceiling debate.
Then there was the fun fact that in December, the federal budget actually had a $53 billion surplus. This was due to payments back from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the mortgage giants, and plus increased tax revenue and, of course, decreased spending under the sequester. Does this play at any... obviously, this was not every month we're going to have a $53 billion surplus, but the numbers from a year ago are tremendously different. I mean, does the fact that the budget actually is in much better health percolate down to actually these discussions they're having, or is it all just theater over?
I think it depends on what you mean by much better health, first of all. You know,
okay.
I mean,
the budget deficit's way down.
The budget deficit's way down, and there is this momentary surplus. $53 billion sounds like a lot of money, and in the context of a state budget, it is, but in the context of the federal budget, it's gone. What's a few billion dollars between friends, right? But you know, if you start talking about the good condition of the budget, you necessarily start talking about what happened in the sequester and what people on both sides of the aisle are trying to do to modify that or roll it back in ways that they find most appealing.
Sure.
And really, you know, on a human level, you have to start talking about what the effects were of cutting, you know. The SNAP program, the food stamp program alone, is a huge big deal. It's going to continue to be a huge big deal. People are not eating. You know, the unemployment insurance debate goes on now, and that's for what a 90-day extension that they're still fighting over.
Yeah.
You know, that we're already 13, 14 days into the new year. That goes on. There's this myriad of programs that got cut back that is having very pronounced, very definite effects right here in your city, right here in the Bay Area. And, you know, saying the budget is in better shape, I think, is kind of subjective. It depends on where you're looking at it from, I think.
True, but just, the end
from
result.
A fiscal health standpoint,
yeah.
Maybe, for the moment.
Well, how it's being allocated is another issue.
Yeah. But it's the issue that's going to determine the fighting, you know, over it, you know, in the next few months, so...
Yeah, I mean, it's just like in the state budget. You know, Jerry Brown's been getting a lot of love for, you know, bringing the state ballot, state budget into balance. But there's still $23 billion, $24 billion in structural debt that they still have to come back. There's, you know, depending on which number, set of numbers you believe, anywhere from $100 billion to $300 billion
in pension
stuff that has to be paid out. Mm-hmm. So these, you know. We were in such a deep hole, and that it, you know, there's still a lot of people who got hurt in that hole. The state budget was, you know, really balanced on the back of the, as Josh was saying, the poorest folks who live here. The state budget, $15 billion were cut there over the last few years, and you know, not a lot of that's going back. So.
I don't think at any point you're going to get while a Democrat is president, you're ever going to get Republicans to say, you know what, things are going pretty well.
Right.
Yeah. Like, they're never going to say, $53 billion, good job, Barack Obama. Right. Thank you very much. We feel much better. We're good. I think, as long as they can still milk something out of it and grandstand on it, they're going to. And even though it's good, they're loath to admit that there's been any progress on this. So I think you're still going to continue to have these debates. And to your point, I mean, we still have lots of debt. I mean, there's still lots of fiscal issues that we have on a federal level. So
sure.
We're certainly not in the clear by any means, and you're not going to get any compliments.
Well, as Joe was talking about the gerrymandering, about the congressional districts and things like that, it does kind of lead us into a discussion of this year. Of course, we just got done with a big election year. So what do we head into? Another election year. Last year wasn't an election year. What am I talking about?
Every year is an election year.
It always feels like an election year.
It's an election lifetime. Well, we're heading into an election year, so at least half of my sentence was correct, and I'm going to bank on that. So let's talk about some of the interesting campaigns around here locally. It didn't look at for a while like it was going to be too interesting, and now we're getting some unexpected, I think, campaigns that are going to be interesting to watch, as well, you know, for congressional seats. And, of course, we've got a number of referenda. So let's start with you, Josh. What are some of the...
Did everybody check their headlines today? Big news in the East Bay. George Miller is retiring from Congress. So now we have an open seat for which one person has already declared candidacy, if you can believe that. Miller's press conference was at 10 o'clock this morning. Mark DeSaunier's press release went out about 4 hours later.
No, I think actually
after careful consideration.
So Sacramento Bee reporter bumped into him in the hall, and he said, yeah, I'm running. And that was, I got that tweet about 7
minutes actually
before Miller's press conference. But the official press release was out.
Right. And there will be other Democrats vying for that seat, almost certainly. It remains to be seen whom, but maybe Tom Torlakson, maybe...
No, this is my story
out?
Today. Yeah. Torlakson out.
Okay. Joan Buchanan?
Is thinking about it.
Thinking about it. John Gioia?
Out.
Fewer than I thought.
Somebody else? Susan Bonilla.
That's why she sent out that very kind statement about the Congress.
Thinking about it, but she... she was going to run for DeSaunier's seat as a state senator out of Concord, and she's going to run for his seat, and she said that may alter that timeline.
Mm.
So that's the classic musical chairs there. Mm-hmm. And a couple, Mary Pifo, the Contra Costa supervisor, we're losing the audience here. No one cares. Nobody cares at this point.
There will be a lot of Democrats running.
A lot of Democrats running. Yeah, well, it's a very safe Democratic.
Okay.
Seat.
Yeah. Well, what about the Mike Honda race?
Ro Khanna continues.
Explain who he is.
Ro Khanna is a former Obama administration official, lives in Fremont, and had raised a record-breaking amount of money in the last quarter of 2011 when people thought that he was going to run to succeed, not challenge, but succeed Congressman Pete Stark. Pete Stark decided not to retire. Connor decided not to challenge him. You know how it ended up for Pete Stark. But Connor then decided that he's going to run. He moved from one side of Fremont to the other, and then decided that he would run against Mike Honda instead. Much to the chagrin of some of the people who had given him money to run against Pete Stark, but with a massive bankroll that he has continued to grow prodigiously ever since, and so he is a serious candidate with a campaign team that was cobbled together from Obama 2012, very high tech effort that's putting feet on the ground already very aggressively for the last 8 months or so.
Got some Obama. Top campaign aides.
Top campaign people. A lot more money, about 3.5 times as much money in the bank as of September 30th as the incumbent Mike Honda has. So,
however, what doesn't he have? Obama's endorsement.
That's right. Yes. For as much as endorsements count, you know, the Democratic leadership has fallen in line very neatly behind Mike Honda.
As they did behind Pete Stark.
As they did behind Pete Stark. Now, Mike Honda is no Pete Stark. Pete Stark, no slight at all against Eric Swalwell, who beat him in 2012. But I think even Congressman Swalwell would admit that his chances were greatly increased by Stark's behavior on the campaign trail with a series of very public and subsequently well-publicized gaffes on his part, including accusing Swalwell of taking bribes in front of a live audience, you know, there was no evidence to support whatsoever. Honda's not likely to make that kind of gaffe. He's not likely to make that kind of mistake. He's got a pretty strong campaign team behind him. He knows how to let his opponent hang himself on his own rope. On the other hand, you know, the millions of dollars that Connor has in the bank buys a pretty big megaphone, and so Connor is now starting, as you would expect a challenger to do. So last week, publicly challenged Honda to a minimum of 4 debates before the primary. And Honda said, well, we'll see who gets into the race. I'm not going to commit to anything yet. And now Connor gets to say, he won't face me. I think both of them will probably tell you accurately that there's not a lot of space, policy space, between Mike Honda and Ro Khanna. They are both fairly liberal Democrats. Fairly liberal being the rub. Khanna's just a little bit more moderate than Mike Honda. Mike Honda's pretty liberal. He is a dyed-in-the-wool, labor-supported, Bay Area liberal. Been a lion of the liberal left for his time there. Khanna, by sort of running a more Silicon Valley-oriented, employer-oriented campaign, shall we say.
Yes. Very nicely done.
Yeah, thank you.
Employer-oriented.
Employer-oriented. you know, still undeniably a Democrat in his policy stances, but now that we have a top two primary system instead of a traditional partisan primary system, all Ro Khanna has to do is finish in the top two with Mike Honda. Mm-hmm. There is a Republican in the race. Don't ask me that person's name. They just got in a few days ago. And it is a district where no Republican can get elected. So it's safe to assume that Honda and Khanna will be in the top two. And then Khanna gets to pick off the anybody but Honda voters. All the Republicans who happen to come to the polls, all of the declined estate people, all of the people who won't vote for Mike Honda will vote for the other person on the ballot if they vote at all. So that becomes, you know, get out the vote effort becomes crucial in a race like that. Okay. And, you know, you just imagine it along the spectrum. You got Mike Honda all the way at the left, and then Ro Khanna right next to him, but he gets all of that space off to the right. There's nobody else there who's going to siphon off all that many votes in November. There's nobody else who will vote do it in November. Only two names on the ballot. So,
well, let's talk about some of the other things that can also impact voter turnout, and that is, this is California, referenda. Mm-hmm. Melissa, what can you talk about, maybe some of the things we'll be seeing this year or that we already know we're going to be seeing?
Well, it's early on, and everyone's collecting signatures right now. I don't know if any of you have been accosted with clipboard carrying persons outside of your grocery stores and things like that. But it is signature gathering time. And you have to collect at least 500,000 for an initiative, about 800,000 for a constitutional amendment, and there are some real doozies swirling around. We got a couple. We got one. We had Tim Draper, who's a Silicon Valley investment banker, or no, he's in just a regular rich guy who invests in things. And he would like California to be split into six states. Actually, what he would really like is for a state called Silicon Valley and then everything else. But he figured out another five, just, you know, like, look fair. So he wants six states. There is a real estate developer in San Diego who would like to expand the state legislature to 12,000 representatives and senators instead of the 120.
And still, the Democrats would control it.
And still, right, we'd have 9,700. Because he feels like people are... But what's interesting about both of these proposals is that they get to the heart of people not feeling like they're being represented. Mm-hmm. Right? So we have, for example, a crisis here in San Francisco, a housing crisis. And if we want to do some things, we need to change state law. But it's really hard to get people who are not in the Bay Area to give... a care about our housing crisis. We are being recorded. Our housing crisis. So it's one of these things where it's frustrating, right? And there, you know, LA can have their water problems, and we're like, whatever. People feel like it's a big state, and are we being fairly represented in our state legislature? And are we, a 38 million person state, being fairly represented by two senators in Washington D.C.? So this idea of let's get fewer states. Let's break it up into fewer states so that we have greater access to the levers of power that are representing us is an important conversation, I think, to have. And these are going out in two different ways, and obviously neither has any chance of passing. But I think that they're bringing up a good debate, which is how connected do we feel to our representatives in Washington and in Sacramento? What is it about our state that is impeding that kind of representation? What are the things that we can do to, if anything, you know, aside from that, to get there? And that's, again, those who are collecting signatures, it's not even clear if they're going to be on the ballot or not. But those are two of my favorites.
Okay. We're certain to see something, or at least a big attempt, to get marijuana legalization on the ballot again.
Five attempts.
It was three just an hour ago. It's five?
Yeah. Well, three that are in circulation right now. I think two more at the AG's office something like that.
Now, are they all the same goal, or do they have...
Well, they all involve smoking. Well, you know, I mean, the devil's in the details with this, right? Everybody's still waiting to see how this plays out in Colorado, which just started selling, and they're waiting to see what's going to happen in Washington. And ultimately, it comes down to, are the feds going to start kicking in the doors at some point in those states that have already voted to legalize? And if they don't, then what is it that they're doing that we should be doing? These initiatives are circulating with some best guess kind of things that, you know, I know at least one or two of them had experts from Colorado come and help draft the language here. But ultimately, this is an experiment still in progress, so we don't really know yet what this is going to come to. I'd be really surprised. First of all, none of these have great funding behind them, as far as I can tell. I'd be surprised if any of them get on the ballot this year. If one did get on the ballot this year, I'd be really surprised to see it pass. I think... It is going to happen in this state. I think it's going to happen in 2016. I don't think it's going to happen.
Yeah, the A-list team is sitting on the sidelines until 2016. That's the one where our very own Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom has come out in favor of legalizing marijuana, and not just the medicinal kind. And he's backed by the ACLU, and they've got some deep pockets. They've got the guy from Progressive Insurance who's going to bankroll it. And they're done extensive polling.
He's dead, actually.
But his
foundation.
His money's bankrolling.
And
so
he lives
so
on.
So they're going to be going out in 2016 on this. Their polling says that that's a much better year. It's a presidential year. There's more younger voters.
You need turnout to pass this.
And younger voters are off the charts on supporting marijuana legalization.
And
if
so,
the insurance company doesn't underwrite it, I think Taco Bell probably will. there are opportunities there.
You jest, but there's a lot of money to be made here. I mean, you've already seen the United Food and Commercial Workers Union organizing the medical shops,
right?
You know, that have sprung up. I mean, there's all kinds of levels of industry that can come to play in a situation like this. There is a lot of potentially corporate money behind it.
$1 billion at least. Well, nobody really knows how much is out there. It's guesstimates, but it's $1 billion at least in California and $3 billion nationally. I mean, that's crazy money.
Has Governor Brown come out on?
No. Not touching it.
No.
He said, no. That's kind of the
answer.
Why would he?
Yeah.
Okay. There's nothing to be gained from him.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about him. He, of course, is running for re-election. Is this going to be a cakewalk?
Yes.
Yes. You can walk in backwards.
That was a controversial question, huh?
Yeah. one of his aides had a very funny quote the other day. He said his opponents are raising enough money to run for, like, a treasurer of, like, a fourth-grade class or something.
Well, I think that's true of the two who are declared. The guy who's coming into the field this month is going to raise a lot more
money. Kashkari will raise
and
money.
He's still going to lose.
Yes, because he's to the left of Jerry Brown on some issues. He's like a Republican who's pro-choice. He's pro-same-sex marriage. He worked for to implement the TARP program, and everybody, you know, the Republicans love that one.
His education and jobs. And economic opportunity. This is a guy who has spent the last year doing things like picking strawberries with migrant workers in Salinas and sleeping in an Oakland homeless shelter overnight. This is a Republican, right? When was the last time? You know, but I mean, it's hard to see him motivating the base in a meaningful way. On the other hand, this will be the first gubernatorial election using the top two primary system, and so it will be Jerry Brown. And I would venture to guess this guy, his name is Neil Kashkari. And, you know, again, the question becomes, does Jerry Brown reach enough of those declined state voters? Or does he grab enough to make it count? I don't see a lot of Democrats, despite Kashkari's social stances, I don't see a lot of Democrats.
He's still got the R next to him, his name, which is very difficult to overcome.
And I think he's going to poll well right up until the point where voters have a one-to-one choice, and then you're going to see stuff start to change.
Someone asked in the audience, what will drive the 2014 midterms and what will be the result? We kind of got into that in terms of not a lot of change in Congress, certainly, but do you see any, you know, sometimes with midterms or in general, you know, presidential year elections, there's a kind of theme that runs through things. There's something that's kind of driving the whole narrative. Joe, do you see anything?
Melissa kind of alluded to it. I think the wealth inequity will be on the ballot in some form, in a couple different forms. There may be Ron Unz, another Republican, conservative Republican, is putting a ballot measure on there that would raise the minimum wage. And that Democrats are like, well, that's good. That helps. That gets out our people. So go ahead and do that. And the other thing that the mayor of San Jose is talking about a pension measure on the ballot that would it's essentially freeze pensions at some level. And that would also bring out the Democratic base, but it would also bring out some conservative Republicans. We also there's still an outside shot about the transgender bathroom bill. That's not the best description of it. But that also may bring out a sliver of conservative Republicans who wouldn't already be on the ballot. Mm-hmm. But those first two are kind of go at the wealth inequity issue, and I think that, you know, maybe someone of the talkers on there. But I got to say, it's, you know, with nothing at the top of the ticket, there's not a whole heck of a lot of real sexy races out there.
Well, someone else asked about the Oakland mayoral race, as there's a new candidate
this week.
That's a
sexy race, yes.
What's sexy about it?
Well, you have Jean Kwan, who is polling some of the most unpopular numbers. I mean, she's one poll, this is going back a couple months, she was like 60% disapproval rating, which is like, 60%? I mean, come on. You have to kill an office to, like, you know, like physically kill someone in your office to get an approval rating at 60%.
Close the bridge, kill someone.
Yeah, exactly. Right. and then drag them through the streets. But the thing is, her challengers are a mixed bag. You have a couple people. You have Joe Tooman, who's a professor at SF State. He's never held public office. He's run for mayor a couple years ago.
Yeah.
You have Brian Parker, who's on the Port Commission. He's a businessman. But again, no public, no elected office experience. You do have Libby Schaff, who is on the council and seen as a more moderate voice in Oakland. Parentheses in Oakland. she does have elected office experience. Rebecca Kaplan, I'm being told she's not going to run, but still is polling well in some of the early polls. It's going to be a very tough uphill climb for the mayor, but in ranked choice voting, what is it, one incumbent has ever lost? So she has history on her side that way, but I don't know about those numbers are tough. Yeah. You know, there's a lot of new restaurants in Oakland. I live in Oakland. Josh lives there and works there. But it's a lot of things haven't changed.
Okay. Well, someone else asked about Governor Brown's support for fracking, and I've, in fact, been seeing a lot of he's been getting some very negative comments, I guess, online. Melissa, is environmentalism going to be perhaps a play a role in his gubernatorial reelection?
No, I don't think so. Just because none of his opponents are going to be, you know, better on it than he is. You know what I mean? Yeah. He's there. You know, who is the Sierra Club going to endorse? But Jerry Brown. They're going to endorse Tim Donnelly. They're going to endorse, you know, a Republican. No, that's not going to happen. And I think part of it is that Jerry Brown knows that.
Yeah.
He's going to win. He's their only hope. There's nobody to the left of him. So they have to go with him. He's got that kind of locked up. So I'm not saying it's not an issue and it's not an important issue, but I'm saying in terms of his reelection, I don't see it playing a role.
If I could get back to maybe some of the other audience questions we've gotten here. One is about the economy. I think we all saw the December jobs figures come in, and they were, we've been getting some good numbers, and then suddenly these were some pretty bad numbers. Is this a one-off, or is this a sign that, okay, the economy maybe is stalling a bit? Any thoughts on that?
The pre-numbers before that, they said that it was going to be even better. I would think everybody was surprised by what it was, and, you know, the number's been going up ever since then, and it looks, who knows, we'll see next month.
Sure.
But, I mean, it seems like the purchasing orders and everything have been rising for months and months and months. I don't know, it seems like a blip, and December of all months should be up. That's a time when there's tons of temporary hiring and such. So that it was really kind of an odd outlier, it seemed like, but who knows.
Okay. A couple questions actually regarding our perennial topic, and I guess the show in a way is almost built on it, and that is political dysfunction. One specifically focusing on the U.S. Senate, says Senator Harry Reid, who's the Democratic leader, the majority leader, did not allow one appropriation bill to come to vote in 2013 in the ordinary course of Senate business. How long will this go on? Nothing's changing in the Senate in the near future, correct?
Well, I mean, if this agreement goes through, this will be, again, a package of 12 appropriations bills that will go to the floor and be voted on.
Those of you listening, notice that Melissa just knocked on wood. Okay. Well, another one refers back to the other dysfunction in New Jersey. This person says, I take the New Jersey affair personally because I live in El Cerrito, which is the Fort Lee of the Bay Area.
How you figure?
Oh, come on. It's better than
Fort
Lee.
Wouldn't Emeryville be the Fort Lee of the Bay Area?
No way.
But basically, the person says,
El Cerrito's better views.
Is this kind of vengeful pettiness par for the course in politics? I mean, there are some politicians you couldn't see doing something like that, and others you'd be like,
you'd be surprised if they didn't.
Yeah. Well, then, how do you see the future of the Republican Party? Will it be around in 30 years? In 20 words or less.
20 words or less. Well, at this trajectory, no. I don't know if it would be 30 years, but no, I think it'll be around.
Quite different, though, right?
Yeah, I think different. I've been talking to folks recently about gay marriage, and the younger generation has no problem with gay marriage, whether they be evangelical Christians or liberal Democrats or what have you. And so if that issue is off the table, which is an issue that is a decider for many people, along with other cultural issues, I'll be a Democrat because Republicans are crazy on social issues. So if that's off the table, then maybe
we'll always have guns.
Yeah.
And abortion, thankfully.
Maybe not.
I was trying to help him out.
I know.
I was trying to help him out.
Melissa? Well, I think political parties are very resilient, and I think that they do change over time. And so what the Republican Party you see today is not necessarily going to be the one you're going to see 30 years from now if you look at the political platform of the 1960s. I mean, it's very different than it was then. So, is it going to be a Republican Party? Yes. And to answer the question a different way, will there be some magical third party that emerges? And I don't think that's the case. I don't think that in modern times that's even possible, given the amount of money that's required to run a party and get on the ballots. I mean, we've just created a machinery that's very different from, you know, with 1860s when the Republican Party first came into being. So no. I mean, people talk about it and Sarah Palin talks about it, but no, there's no third party. What you're going to see is sort of a realignment between the parties as we go forward, as the issues change.
Yeah, I think that much like Silicon Valley drives a lot of things, I think Silicon Valley is going to start driving the Republican Party to be a more libertarian party.
Yeah.
And it's a get off of our backs government on business, get off our backs government on, you know, everything.
I can't believe we've gotten to this point in the program without uttering the word immigration, right? I mean, it's,
hey, Josh, what about immigration?
How about immigration? Well, yeah, how about it? You know, I think the Republican Party is at some point going to come to grips with the fact that it's going to be mighty hard to win a national election until there is some sort of agreement reached on immigration reform. I think a lot of people recognize that in the immediate aftermath of the 2012 election and then immediately forgot it in 2013. And 2014, I'm not holding my breath, but heading into 2016, yeah, I'll bet you're going
to
see
that
something.
That might go to your June after the primaries are taken. You might see a little movement on that then. But, yeah, the window on that was wide open, and they couldn't do it.
Right. Well, I think it goes to your point about 2020 maybe being the more appropriate time, because it's going to take some redrawing of districts. Right now, even though sort of writ large, yes, immigration is a big deal, and yes, it's important to people who vote in presidential elections, but if I'm going home to my district where I am going to win no matter what I say or do because I'm a Republican or a Democrat. I mean, there's really the way districts are drawn right now for so many of these districts, there's just no incentive to even care. You know, so what if I make the whole party look bad? My people at home love me, and that's who sends me to Washington, D.C., and that's who pays my bills. So to heck with, you know, whoever's presidential aspirations. I'm going to do what I want to do. And until you get a new census, and until you just start drawing lines again in a different way, I don't think you're going to see there's no incentive, to your point earlier, there's no incentive for people to coalesce. I mean, again, for them, getting a president elected may not be that important.
Okay. Before we get to our news quiz, we have one more question, and we've had great questions. I'm sorry I can't get to all of them, but this is talking about something we had talked about in the green room before, which is certain, you know, revenue measures that are on the board, one of which is transportation stuff. I wonder if you had any thoughts on, are we going to, if you will, relitigate through the referenda high-speed rail?
Well, Assemblyman Gorell today, was it today or yesterday, filed the paperwork to put the measure on the ballot that would repeal high-speed rail. And it's titled something really funny. It's like, repeal the $100 billion high-speed rail for education. it was just like, well done, sir. But it's the second time we've had just sort of had an attempt to put this on the ballot. It's not clear it's going to be on the ballot. But if it is, remember, Jerry Brown has years ago arranged to put on the ballot, sort of right next to it, this water bond. So $11 billion for water stuff that I don't really understand. But and that way I'm like most California voters. So you're going to see. So this whole idea of like large infrastructure projects is going to be kind of litigated. Again, assuming this high-speed rail thing gets back on, and it's got a good chance because it's just horribly unpopular. Then you're going to sort of have these two things side by side, and you talk about, you know, trying to get turnout. People are really, really invested in getting these projects going. Particularly, public employee unions and other construction unions want the high-speed rail. They want that work. This could shape up to be a huge, huge fight.
And this is one of the few things on which Jerry Brown is potentially vulnerable to attacks by his opponents, because he is all in on this. You know, he's the old school style of politician who is infrastructure legacy. building something big, dreaming big. He was talking about it in these terms during the budget rollout last week. And he wants to see this high-speed rail project go forward, and it is wildly unpopular, as you said. And if indeed this initiative gets on the ballot, then it would be interesting to see what kind of resources he diverts in terms of time and money and energy from his own reelection bid to try to shore up high-speed rail as we go into November.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, this is your chance to win a little prize. We like to end our programs here with a little bit of a news quiz. So what I'm going to do is ask questions. If you think you know the answer, raise your hand. I'll call on you. And if you get it right, you'll get this incredibly valuable Lindor
truffle. The bags were bigger last
time. What the hell is that?
It was Christmas. You know what? Don't listen to the peanut gallery. Okay. So let's start with the first question. And Robert will be delivering the...
Hold on. Can I bump up the prize package?
What's
you
this?
Get a keep the frack out of my water sticker. Along so here you go. Here, throw that in. Yeah, come on.
I'm going to save that for one of the tougher questions.
Yeah, I got nothing.
Okay. The first one, not with a sticker, is the partner of French President Hollande has been hospitalized after a magazine claimed what? I saw your hand first, sir.
Husband had an affair.
That's right.
On a moped.
Right.
On a moped.
Wait, yeah, so
in France, I'm shocked.
Yeah, I know. His pictures of him, he's got the little helmet
on. Give it away to a neighbor if you don't want it.
That's right. Exactly.
Yeah. Do you want the sticker?
No, she likes the candy.
Second question. What former Israeli prime minister died on Saturday? Sir, in the purple, yes. That is correct. And you know what comes with that? A sticker. Okay, so you remember this New Jersey schedule that scandal that we started out talking about. Well, one of those emails between Christie's underlings referred mockingly to the mayor in question as, quote, the little Serbian, unquote. He's not Serbian. What is he? And your hand went, ma'am, your hand went right up. Sorry? You are correct.
All right. There we go. Wait, we have a special bonus. Hey, don't frack with our air sticker. I was cleaning up my desk
so
the other day.
I just said,
and why do you carry them with you?
I got it at a convention. I was cleaning up my desk, and I threw it in my file.
Okay, next question.
I'm out, by the way.
New York's new mayor, Bill de Blasio, has gotten into hot water for committing a faux pas with the city's beloved, if undercooked, pizza. What did he do? And, sir, your hand was up right away.
I objected to the
question. Yeah. Sorry? He ate it with a fork. That's right.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
He would probably
get
truffles with
a
fork,
that?
Too.
Yeah.
So.
Who does that?
Chicagoans.
Yeah, that's true. But they, it's at least
don't
a
tell
deep.
John Stewart.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, right?
It's awful.
Next question. Ronald Reagan's former press secretary died this week. What was his name? Yes.
Speaks.
That's right. Larry Speaks.
Good knowledge.
Appropriate
good.
Name.
Actually, I think you're correct. They never gave him that exact title because he became the acting press secretary after Jim Brady was shot. Okay, question number six. This week, Hillary and Bill Clinton's friend and former aide Terry McAuliffe was sworn in as governor of what state? Yes, sir.
Virginia.
That's correct.
No.
It's a Commonwealth. Well, yeah, we should like that then. We're the Commonwealth Club. Okay. World Powers announced this weekend that what deal would take effect in January? Sir, again.
But Iran is going to shut down the nukes, stop making. They're going to reduce their uranium stock.
And he even had details on the deal.
Jeez,
that is
good. Give the rest of the damn bag. Jeez. He's got
Must really like that
kid. The guy likes truffles, okay? What can we say? I'll make sure I'm looking at other folks, too. What professional athlete was suspended for an entire season for drug charges? In the back there, sir. That's correct. You would, please? Two more. Egypt's army chief has announced plans for his future. What are his plans? He wants to run for president. That's correct.
Oh.
Yeah. Oh. Okay. Final question. Who is suing Nike for $100 million? Does anyone know this? Who is suing Nike, the shoemaker, for $100 million? Nobody knows this? Am I going to walk home with a...
Someone who thought they were going to beat somebody with a pair of Jordans or something like that? Is it that story? I just started.
Yeah, it is. It is in fact a. This is not a good story. A pimp in Oregon who was wearing Nike shoes when he stomped on the face of a victim. He's suing because the shoe company failed to provide a warning label that using their shoes as a weapon could cause harm to a user.
So. To the user.
Yes, to the user.
Way to finish on a high note, John.
I'm sorry. It's the news.
Leave him laughing.
Listen, thanks for our panel, Joe Garofoli, Josh Richmond, and Melissa Griffin King. Thanks to all of you for joining us tonight and listening online. That's our program for this week. Don't forget to join us in just 2 weeks for our next week-to-week program on Monday at noon on January 27th. Have a great week, everyone.